James Wayman joins the Platopia podcast this time as we discuss biometrics, automated human identification. Dr. Wayman has devoted his career to the study and implementation of biometric means of identification. He has appeared as an expert witness in many court cases involving biometrics.
We cannot recognize people from drones, regardless of what you've heard. We can't recognize them from drones. We can't recognize them at 100 meters, and that's due to air scintillation more than anything else. We cannot recognize them at a high angle. So now this is interesting. I love to volunteer my time for criminal cases, and I get a lot of phone calls from public defenders who don't have any money, and that's fine. I'm happy to do that. And they say, the police have some images of a bank robber, and they say it's my client. Can you show that these images from the bank are not my client? And so she sends me a nice picture of her client, right? Driver's license or something. And then sends me these pictures from the bank of the top of a head where the guy's wearing a hat. No, I cannot testify that that person is not your client. Although I will be happy to testify that the prosecution can't testify that it is the client.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lepkoski, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. I'm always joined by Scoop and Wendy. We're a great trio, and we probably step on each other from time to time, but we have great fun interviews, and today we're going to have a great interview, especially because our guest is Jim Wayman, who's an expert in automated human recognition and biometrics, which is the general ability of technology to identify and authenticate individuals. I had some biometric checks as I was traveling recently. They were comparing, I guess, my image through a camera to my ID. I believe that's what they were doing at the airport. So, Jim, how did you get into this particular field?
Yeah, I was interested in acoustics, and I was interested in computational acoustics. And this was all back in the 1970s, and the field of biometrics was not identified as such till 1981. And so there were also some changes in availability of computational hardware. We could take analog voice signals and convert them to numbers very, very quickly and cheaply starting in the early 80s. And so I was in the right place at the right time, and I got involved in speaker recognition technology just at the time where this the term biometrics was being employed for automated human identification. And there was a growing awareness that all of these technologies, in fact, had a core commonality. In other words, prior to 1980, you had a little bit of face recognition, you had voice speaker recognition, you had fingerprint recognition, you had some signature recognition, but people didn't understand that there was a commonality of the field here. And starting about 1980, we understood there was a commonality of the field. We named the field biometrics, and there I was doing computational acoustics, and so I got thrown in very quickly to computational speaker recognition, was not very successful at that. And I was working for the U.S. government at the time, and they said, look, it's not your fault. You're just working with a small group that is new to the field. What we want you to do is broaden your interests to other forms of automated human recognition, now called biometrics. For instance, start studying fingerprinting, start studying, iris hadn't come along at that point. Retinal recognition was around. Start studying fingerprinting, start studying hand geometry recognition, start studying retinal recognition, and we'll pay you some money to do all that. And so that's what got me started.
So you've got potentially various kinds of, like you have facial recognition, you have fingerprints, you have voice recognition. Which of those is most accurate?
Well, first thing to realize is we don't use the term accuracy. Because like in any measurement technique, you have false positives and false negatives, and they both can be considered accuracy metrics. But in biometrics, we have some additional problems. We have things we call failure to acquire. and failure to enroll. And this really throws any attempt to talk about accuracy into kind of a perplexing situation. So for example, I did a test with the Department of Defense here in the US where I was going into the lab about 1 week a month, and we were preparing to do a biometric test just with our own lab personnel before we expanded this to a larger organization. We didn't want to embarrass ourselves by screwing up a test before a whole big group of people. So we said, look, we'll just try running a test on the 20 people in our lab and see what happens. Let's run the 20 people in the lab through 10 times each, and we'll see what happens. And I made the statement then that, well, I think about one out of every 20, about 5% of your transactions won't be recognized. They'll be wrongly not recognized. False non-match is what we call it. I'm just going to guess that. And so I went off and I came back a month later. I said, so how did that test go? Did you get the 200 samples? And they said, yes, we did. And I said, so how did it go? They said, oh, you are completely wrong. We didn't have any false non-matches. I said, well, that's great. Well, that's wonderful. Well, except for Tony. Tony couldn't enroll in the system to begin with. And Tony was the one out of 20. Meaning, okay, all right. You made the enrollment criteria such that people that could not give a consistent biometric measure could not be in the system in the first place. So you might say that that system had 100% accuracy on 95% of the participants. And that's one of the things we see repeatedly is that people want to talk about very, very low error rates, right, on the people that can use the system, right? They don't count or have no way of counting the number of people that are not able to use the system. And so there is this hidden error rate associated with all this stuff that prevent us from talking about simply about, say, the false non-match rate or the false match rate. And so the terms accuracy really have to be broken down into different areas, different types of accuracy.
My favorite thing that you ever said to me was people never have what you think they're going to have, where you think they're going to have it. And I think it was right after you told me the story of the guy with two right thumbs.
Right. That was a big learning experience for me. We collected in the Philippines for a Philippine government test, several thousand fingerprints from about 800 volunteers, something like that. And the data collection protocol accommodated for the fact we understood very, very well that not everybody has 10 fingers. Some people lose fingers, and we had a protocol for that. And we could handle it no problem. So in rolling this thing out, you always want to, with a test, you always want to start small and in a non-embarrassing situation. Right. You don't want to roll out a test to 600 or 800 people where you screw it up. Everybody knows you screwed it up. So in this particular case, again, we had about 20 people. I said, welcome 20 team members. Thank you. I want to show you this test that we're going to be doing on a much larger population. I want to get a few volunteers up here. We're going to be collecting fingerprints. Can I get a volunteer to come up? And this one fellow whose name, well, I will tell you his name because it's a common name. It's Raphael. His name was Raphael. And he said, yes, I will volunteer. Okay, great. Rafi, come on up. I said, put your right thumb on the scanner. And he held up his hand. He said, which right thumb? And that was a revelation to me because polydactylism is very common among births. But here in the United States, we whack off any vestigial finger right at birth. My wife said the first time she saw this, she cried. A beautiful baby was born. And the first thing they did was haul it off to surgery, postnatal surgery, and whacked off its finger. They never do that in the Philippines. And you probably have heard about some professional baseball players. There was a professional pitcher, I think, for the Dodgers that had six fingers and had special mitt made for his hand. And he had six fingers on each hand that were apparently usable. I came across a real interesting case, two interesting cases. I don't want to mention the country, and I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I was aware that not everybody has two eyes because I had a roommate once that had a glass eye, and that's understandable. I had never encountered anybody with only one eye socket. And on two separate trips overseas, I encountered two different people with only one eye socket. Now, in other words, the the face looks somewhat like that. I suppose the eye socket was surgically covered. I don't know. Obviously, you can't walk up to this person and say, "Excuse me, I understand you have only one eye socket." We did encounter a person with non-horizontally placed eye sockets that were one was slightly above and below the other one. All of these problems, all of these issues cause problems for the facial recognition systems. The facial recognition systems operate on the assumption that everybody has at least two eye sockets, and the eye sockets are horizontally placed. And if that's not true, the system I can't deal. The system just doesn't know what to do. And so when you start asking, well, what are the error rates? Well, what are the percentage of anomalies in the population? I'm sorry, I'm telling too many anecdotes, but I got one more for you. One of the things we learned in the Philippine data collection is not everybody has friction ridges on their fingers. Not everybody has these smooth ridges. Sometimes the ridges simply get worn away and disappear, but other times people have never had them. They're congenital defects. There's a whole class of issues called ichthyoderm. Ichthyodermitis, ichthyoderm, meaning fish skin. And we encountered this in the Philippines, and I had never seen it before. Okay, that's very interesting. I looked it up and I discovered that it's not an uncommon situation. So I'm sitting at my desk and I get a phone call. And a woman introduces herself as a dermatologist from one of the Cedars-Sinai hospitals. I don't remember which one. There are a million Cedars-Sinai hospitals. And I said, "Oh, doctor, this is terrific. I said, what brings you to call me?" And she says, "Do you have any estimate for the prevalence of ichthyoderm in the population?" And I just laughed. I said, "Well, doctor, that was a question I wanted to ask you." Right? So if you do not have fingerprints, the fingerprint system is absolutely worthless. And so when you talk about accuracy rates, well, are you going to talk about the percentage of people that can't use the system to begin with? Because we don't know what that percentage is. We don't have any good statistics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I fell into that a couple of weeks ago, flying into Canada and going through customs. And, they take a picture, facial recognition. And a message flashed on the screen telling me to remove my mask. I wasn't wearing a mask. I just have a,
Yes. I love it. I love it. So does that count as an error? So when you ask accuracy, let's not talk about accuracy. Let's talk about error rates. That's how we like to talk about it. So is that an error for the system? Would that error have been previously measured and reported in a laboratory test? Probably not. In other words, you can look up error rates on the NIST. NIST is National Institute of Standards and Technology. It's a division of the Department of Commerce. You can look up error rates for various named algorithms, facial recognition algorithms on the NIST website. But those are all laboratory tests, and they have excluded any faces where they can't find a face, any images where they can't find a face. They've excluded any images where you're not looking directly at the camera, or maybe even excluded images. I don't know quite the protocol where the eyes are not parallel. And so you get these fabulously low error rates. But of course, in practice, we get orders and orders and orders of magnitude higher because people like you come along wearing masks.
In the UK, the police have been trying to do live facial recognition where they station a van outside a tube station or something, and they take an image of everybody who walks by, and they try to match them against a database of known wanted criminals and things. And a lot of people are very alarmed about this. And of course, what they're saying is, oh, we have fixed the there they it doesn't make errors more than 1 in 33,000 now, or something like this. And but it, the bias in the training data has been a known problem for a long time, and I find it hard to believe they've actually overcome it.
I worked for 18 years for the British government in the area of biometrics, as you know, and I worked very closely with those people. I still work with those people. They're not naive. They're very aware of the problem of false positives and false negatives. Here, the problem would be false positive. They pull someone off the street who they think matches and then doesn't. They're very aware of that problem. They're trying to be sensitive to it. And there's a lot of ways of being sensitive to these problems. They don't have to say, "We just matched you against someone on our watch list." They say, "Can we talk to you for another minute or two and get this clarified?" The best people in the world for dealing with problems are is Disney World. Disney World down in Florida has been using some form of biometric recognition since the mid 1990s. They started with two finger shadows, the shadow of two fingers, and now they're moved to fingerprint. But they have very, very sensitive techniques in place for dealing with their mistakes when somehow something doesn't seem to match. They're very, very clever, and they've done a good job. Similarly, the London Metropolitan Police are running this, are not nuts and they're not crazy. And they know very well, because they've talked to people like me, that these errors are to be expected. They're built into the process. And where we got into trouble in the United States, you may recall the problem, a very high profile problem called Robert Williams. You may remember the Robert Williams case, but there have been several cases where police, untrained police forces, found some match someplace and went to arrest the guy. No. You don't arrest anybody. This gives you a lead. I mean, police forces get all kinds of crazy leads all the time. I mean, there are stories of police forces using psychics, right? Okay. Whatever floats your
Sure.
boat, right? Whatever floats your boat to develop a lead, I can call up and say, Wendy Grossman is the serial killer, right? It's just a crazy ass lead. And they've got to treat it as such. And this probably isn't true. But the problem with the Robert Williams case is they didn't treat it that way. They treated it as though they had a definite match. It's definitely this guy that robbed the bank, I think it was. And that's where they got into trouble. Now, these are just leads. And so, with the case, getting back to your case of the Metropolitan Police there in London, this is just a lead. It doesn't mean anything. And they know that. And they handle it appropriately. Now, that doesn't mean I'm justifying what they're doing. There are a lot of reasons why you say, well, we don't want them out there doing that in the street. But all of this happened, maybe you can remember, in the late 90s, Somethingham Township. This was on the south side of the river.
Are you thinking of Newham?
Newham, that's exactly what a Newham
Because they were the
Township.
first people to put in
Yes.
CCTV cameras.
Yes, and it didn't work. But one thing that did happen is by advertising it, they found that all the petty crime left Newham Township and went off to other related townships.
Yeah, but in some townships, in some towns, what they found was that the drug dealers started using the cameras. They started actually carrying out deals in front of the cameras because they figured they wouldn't get mugged.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Crazy.
That's brilliant.
I went to a biometrics conference where this guy was talking about that. Yeah.
I hadn't heard that. That's terrific. Unintended consequences. Yes. So this whole field is nothing but unintended consequences, and you have to be aware of the stuff you're not aware of, the
Well,
unknown unknowns.
biometrics has been all over the news this week because of TSA PreCheck and Clear making it easier to get through the TSA checkpoints. And a lot of complaints were immediately raised about who protects that biometric data that they will be using, and how secure is it? And that's been a problem with a lot of people's objections to some biometrics, is this is a very leaky society these days. It's pretty easy to get data, but it's really hard to keep it safe.
Boy, you're so right. Do you remember the original Clear? Maybe, let's review Clear a little bit. There was a Clear company that collected iris and face images for border crossing at airports. My wife enrolled in that. And then they went bankrupt. And so the question was, what assets do they have to sell in the bankruptcy proceeding? Can they sell their assets of biometric images, was the question. And the courts ruled, no, you can only sell your assets to another company doing exactly the same kind of business. So a new company was started, or a new company bought Clear. It's now called Clear again, or maybe Clear Secure. And they bought those assets, but that's a big problem. What happens to those assets? Can they be bought and sold? And in particular, Illinois and Texas in the United States have legislation saying that cannot happen. I don't know what the current EU or UK legislation is on that, but they probably have something to prevent large-scale biometric databases from being bought or sold. Wendy probably knows.
Well, there's data protection law, so I think it might count as a change of use. Yeah. When I met you, we met in around 2001, 2002. I found Jim in some congressional, his name in some congressional testimony on biometrics, and I forget what I was writing, but I tracked him down at San Jose State University. And I get back an email from AOL, and I'm thinking, well, that's a little odd. And then we planned to meet, and we were going to meet on a Sunday, which I thought was odd, at the train station. And when we went to his office, what he said was his office, he couldn't get in because the system wasn't working. And by this time, I'm starting to think, you know, who is this guy? But at the time, the reason you couldn't get into your office was some facial recognition system wasn't working because the vendor had gone bust or something, and you hadn't been able to get the equipment maintained. And you said that was a huge problem at the time. Has that gotten more stable? Are we still, we are actually seeing companies that actually have some longevity now, right?
Yeah, the smaller companies at the time have been taken over by the larger ones. For instance, NEC, which you've heard of, a Japan Electric Company, and IDEMIA, which is a big French company, own a lot of this and sell a lot of their products to the U.S. government, and they're quite stable. It's interesting that a lot of the U.S. government systems are procured from overseas companies.
That is interesting, because in most parts of technology, Europe is dependent on the states, and this is becoming a big issue here. Particularly because under the Patriot Act, the U.S. government can demand to see data that is held by the overseas subsidiary of a U.S. company. So people are very concerned. You know, like parts of the U.K. government run on WhatsApp.
Oh, really?
And everybody is dependent on Microsoft. Yeah. And I think it's the German government that has decided to try to ensure that it has its entire own technology stack. And there's a kind of push for that in a lot of parts, because, you know, people are kind of nervous now about the U.S.
I wonder why. You know, another thing I wonder about is in movies, I've seen situations where they slice somebody's hand off and use their finger for fingerprint recognition. Does that really work?
Yeah, and there are easier ways to do it than that. You can pick up somebody's fingerprint off a glass, and you can create a artificial finger image that then you can attach to your finger and put it down. So, and that's, I don't think there's any criminality there, except the criminality of impersonating someone, the identity fraud. But I think cutting off somebody's hand is a bit extreme and would expose, it'd be detectable, it would expose you to other processes. Find an easier way, get a fingerprint off a glass. Oh, or there are other ways too. Let me explain. there are far easier ways. One of the people that all this business of spoofing fingerprinting goes back to 1905, and there's a great paper written by the Israeli police around 1999 called A Chronological History of Fingerprint Forgeries. And in that paper, you can find this whole issue of fingerprint forgeries traced back to about 1907 or 1905 or something. In the 1990s, there was a very, very clever Dutch guy named Ton, T-O-N, Vander P-U-T-T-E, who wrote a paper called Biometrical Fingerprinting, Don't Let Your Fingers Get Burned. And the reason I point that out is that paper is still available online. He not only pointed out how to defeat fingerprint systems, he pointed out in that paper how to defeat the countermeasures intended to prevent defeat of those systems. And Ton Vanderput was really a very, very clever person. I have not had contact with him for 20 years, but that original paper is still very, very viable. It tells you not only how to spoof the fingerprint system, but how to defeat any anti-spoofing efforts that the fingerprint system is attempting.
So what I always like to ask scientists is, what are the hard problems you're working on? I mean, the thing you said to me in 2002 was the unsolved problem is people. And I suppose we haven't managed to fix people. But what are the hard things that people are trying to solve now?
Well, I could talk about some that I'm trying to get some traction on. You have 10 fingers, right? Suppose you put all 10 fingers down, and suppose on record you have what we call a reference, an enrollment reference of 10 fingers. How do you compare 10 fingers to 10 fingers and make a decision as to whether it's the same person or not? Do all 10 fingers have to match, or do only one finger match? And the same is true of facial images. Suppose I have several facial images of you, and I can match a face to your facial image. Do I match it to just one of the images? Do I attempt to match it to all of the images? This is called monomodal fusion. And since the 1970s, people have been talking about multimodal fusion. And every time I hear about multimodal fusion, I want to stop them and say, no, the first thing we have to do is have a good handle on monomodal fusion. And so that's one of the big unsolved mysteries right now, is how best to combine 10 fingerprint comparisons to 10 fingerprint comparisons and make a decision as to whether the two are from the same individual, or five face comparisons to five face comparisons, that kind of thing. That's one big unsolved problem that we have. Another unsolved problem, people are very excited about contactless fingerprints. This is the idea that you take a picture of my finger and that you use that so that I don't have to touch a surface. These contact fingerprint systems, and I've tested them, are not yet ready for prime time, but people don't know that. They're very hard to use, very high failure to acquire rate. We talked about that earlier, where I said that one in 20 people couldn't use them. We get a lot worse statistics for the contactless fingerprinting. And contactless fingerprinting runs a whole lot of technical problems. It's not at all like contact fingerprinting. And let me see if I can make this fast and simple without going into too much detail. In contact fingerprinting, you're reflecting light off of a piece of glass. And wherever your finger contacts the glass, the light does not reflect. There's no light being reflected off the finger, so you don't have to worry about something called albedo, which is the reflectance of the finger itself. But as soon as you do contactless fingerprinting, you're reflecting light off a finger, and the finger could be dry, the finger could be moist. The light could be reflecting from the ridges, the light could be reflecting from the valleys. It could change depending on the angle of the light and the angle of the camera. This half of the finger might be reflecting light off the valleys. This half might be reflecting light off the ridges. You got yourself some big problems. And then people have to be able to hold their hand appropriately in front of the camera. So there's a lot of what I believe unwarranted excitement right now about contactless fingerprinting. But some people like the FBI have put their foot down and said, not in our garage. You're not doing that here. You're not coming over to our place with contactless fingerprints. And the FBI is very right to hold that line. Contactless fingerprinting is not there yet. And NIST, again, National Institute of Standards and Technology, has also done a very responsible job in putting out some reports on contactless fingerprinting and giving some rules for if you must use this, if you really think you have to use contactless fingerprinting, let's warn you of how you have to do it and the fact that you need to save the original pictures. These aren't fingerprints as we know them. You know, fingerprints, when I say fingerprint, you think of these ridge lines, black ridges and white valleys. NIST is saying, no, save the picture to begin with. And that way, if you can improve the computer program that converts the picture into these black ridges and valleys, you can always go back to the photo and recompute. Not everybody is as cautious as I am, or as cautious as NIST is, or as cautious as the FBI is. A lot of groups want to push forward with contactless fingerprinting. Okay, but there's a warning. So your original question was, what outstanding research areas are there? My highest priority right now is monomodal fusion before we attempt to move to multimodal fusion. And then it would be contactless fingerprinting and getting a much better handle on that and why we think we need to use it and whether we think we need to use it or not. And let me think if I can come up with any other. DNA, rapid DNA analysis has always been high on the list. DNA analysis takes now a minimum of 45 minutes. Is it doable? If in some applications, it certainly wouldn't be in 45 minutes. So there's still some emphasis on speeding up the DNA process. I don't know how that's going at all. I don't monitor that stuff. So let's see. I think that's about all I can think of. Well, face recognition at a distance at an angle has always been big. And there was recently completed, I believe, a IARPA project, Intelligence Advanced Research Project Agency, funded by the intelligence community here in the United States, called BRIAR, Biometric Recognition at Range and at Altitude and Range, I guess. Biometric recognition at altitude and range. We cannot recognize people from drones, regardless of what you've heard. We can't recognize them from drones. We can't recognize them at 100 meters. And that's due to air scintillation more than anything else. We cannot recognize them at a high angle. So again, now this is interesting. I'd love to volunteer my time for criminal cases. And I get a lot of phone calls from public defenders who don't have any money. And that's fine, I'm happy to do that. And they say, the police have some images of a bank robber and they say it's my client. Can you show that these images from the bank are not my client? And so she sends me a nice picture of her client, right? Driver's license or something. And then sends me these pictures from the bank of the top of a head where the guy's wearing a hat. No, I cannot testify that that person is not your a client, although I will be happy to testify that the prosecution can't testify that it is the client on the basis of these images. These images are of no value in this investigation whatsoever, and I will testify that to whoever you want me to testify that to. So I got caught one time offering to do that because the defense attorney sent me this video that was kind of taken into the sun. And you couldn't see enough of the guy's face to make any statement at all. But at one point, the guy turns his head and you could see very clearly his ear and it blocked out the sun. So we had a good image of his, I believe it was left ear, or maybe it was a right ear. I don't quite remember now. Well, isn't that interesting? Now, ear recognition is not, it has been done. There are not any standards for how it should be done. And so given the lack of standards, you can say anything you want to say about it. But I thought certainly if the ears, this is called a pinea, if the pineas clearly did not match, if they showed clear differences, we could bring that out in court and say, listen, there's no way this guy's ear is the one in the picture because look at these differences in the structure of the pinea. And so I said to the lawyer, please send me a picture of your client's right ear. The full frontal photos you sent me are insufficient. If you can send me a photo of your client's right ear, there's something that we might be able to say to exclude your client as a possible source of the image. Didn't hear back from her. Finally, 2 weeks later, I heard back from her. And she said, oh, I have very bad news. My client was released on bail and was shot to death in a drug deal gone bad last week. So the case went away. Because the accused drug dealer, who no one proved was involved in the drug deal, was shot 2 weeks later in a drug deal gone bad. So I don't know. But anyway.
And you never got a picture of his ear.
No, never got a picture of his ear. And ear recognition, although there's not a big call for it, there is a call for it. There was a need for this in one of the recent war crime trials against a Nazi, World War II Nazi. There were images of the Nazi prison guard that dated from 1943 or 44 or something. And the Nazi prison guard was brought into court. This was in the last 10 years. And obviously it looked very, very different. If it was the same person, he had aged, what was that, 70 years in the meantime. And there was some hope that perhaps ear recognition would work. And my friend Mark Nixon at the University of Southampton, who Wendy may know, Mark Nixon was given that project, but he determined there was not enough resolution in the side photos they had from 1944 to allow him to make any statements at all about the similarity to the ear of the accused person. So anyway, there's a lot of work to be done left to be done, and it's a lot of exciting work, and this is fun stuff.
I was thinking about 3 decades ago when I worked on a biometrics project, and it was fingerprinting, right? And one of the members of our group was very concerned about privacy issues. And her thing was, we're not going to use the index finger because everybody else uses the index finger. So we're going to use a different finger so that it can't be matched with any other biometric data collection. And I've often wondered if that was really going to make that much of a difference.
Well, the federal government takes all 10 fingers, so if
Yeah.
you're worried about government databases, they have all 10 fingers.
It probably wouldn't have made any difference at all. So, is there anything that is you would consider an advance in this technology that really, really surprised you?
Oh, what really surprised me is the facial advances in facial recognition, owing to these deep convolutional neural networks. So let's back up. Let's talk a little bit about the history of facial recognition because that's kind of important. Francis Galton wrote a paper on recognizing profiles in 1882, but in terms of quantifying all of this, nothing much happened until the early 1960s. And the CIA funded a guy named Woodrow W. Bledsoe to start a company called Panoramic Research Incorporated in Silicon Valley to look at how we might automatically match faces. And so he had this idea that I can't remember what he called them. We call them now landmarks, fiducial points. He's going to take two images and he's going to mark the corner of the eyes, the nostrils, the edges of the mouth, and then he's going to try to overlay these things on top of each other and see if he gets a match. Now, he was much more clever than that. I'm oversimplifying what he did because after he marked these points, he said, "Now I'm going to assume these points sit on a sphere." Right? They're not, a face isn't flat. It sits on a sphere. And I've got another set of points sitting over here on another sphere. I want to find out if these two spheres can be rotated into each other so that the points lie on top of each other. That's what he tried to do. And so it was all based on the locations of the points of the eyes, the ears, the nose, and the mouth. There was a very nice PhD thesis done then by Kanade. Takeo Kanade, very heavily respected, now professor emeritus at Carnegie Mellon University, heavily respected in the whole area of image processing. He did a PhD thesis, I want to say at the University of Osaka. I may have that slightly wrong, back around 1968, 1970. And that thesis has been published online where he was trying to expand this concept of finding particular points on a face. And I hope I'm not going too far with too many anecdotes, but Professor Kanade had an exhibition at the Osaka Expo in 1970. You know, there's an Osaka Expo going on now. It's a repeat 55 years later of the 1970 Osaka Expo. And in the Japanese pavilion, he had this system set up, and it said this: "Is your face more like John Wayne, John Kennedy, or Marilyn Monroe? Stand in front of the facial recognition system, and we will tell you." The idea was you would find the ratio of distance between the two eyes to the distance from the eye in the corner of the mouth, and that's what would determine whether your ratio was more like John Wayne's, John Kennedy's, or Marilyn Monroe. And he told me, I was talking to him some years ago. He told me, you know, we looked at the data afterwards, and eyes were being found up here, and mouths were being found down here, and it was just kind of a big mess. But he said this was the perfect exhibit for the Osaka Exposition. He said, why? Because number one, there is no ground truth, and number two, everybody goes away happy. Oh yes, I'm the Marilyn Monroe type, right? So. That
If your only knowledge of biometrics came from
television detective shows. How far off is that? Have you graded any of those shows on their accuracy or their reality?
We love to laugh about them. They'll show these things at conferences so that everybody can get a good laugh. No, it doesn't work that way. And one of the things that I point out with regard to these defense lawyers that call me, they think it does. They think, can you get access to any of these systems that flip through all of these faces and find exactly the right guy with 100% positive identification? No, none of them work that way. Just to finish my point about facial recognition is that we continued this way until the 1980s when we dropped the whole idea of finding points on a face. If anybody tells you facial recognition works by comparing distances between the eyes and the nose, they don't know anything about facial recognition. They've been a hermit since the 1960s. In the 1980s, we went to a different thing at all. We said we're going to look at filtered areas here and here and here. And there was a very, very successful system on elastic bunch graph matching. And it was a German professor von der Marlsberg, Christoph von der Marlsberg, that operating under US funding, put together a very, very successful system that allowed us to start using the system commercially. And we used that commercially up until, I'm going to make up a date, but about approximately correct, say 2012, 2014. And that's when this neural net stuff started coming along, these convolutional neural networks, and blew all that out of the water. And so now we have these convolutional neural networks that are really of general architecture. You pull one down off the internet, and then you start modifying it to do faces as opposed to boats and planes and trains. And so a lot of conference papers we get now are, oh, I pulled down this standard convolutional neural net, and I trained it in this particular way, and I changed the objective function in this particular way, and I got these really wonderful results. Okay. The point being that now these things are black boxes. They don't do anything inside that we know what they're doing. I mean, I can explain the mathematics to you, but it doesn't mean anything in terms of faces. In other words, I can explain that there's integer multiplications going on, and that we're doing, say, 9 integer multiplications, and then we're picking the highest value. I can explain all that to you, but you're going to say, well, what does that have to do with faces? I don't know. We just seem at the end of the process to get very, very good results. And so the systems that are going in now are very accurate systems based on these deep convolutional neural networks that nobody really understands how they work or how they fail. And the failure modes are probably more fascinating than their working modes, but that's a whole other subject.
I'm wondering about government regulation. Are there any attempts to regulate biometric technologies, particularly privacy regulations?
Well, certainly there's more going on in Wendy's world than in my world. In my world, it's done at the state level. We have the Biometric Information Protection Act in Illinois that allows individuals to sue companies for violations. A violation would be they took my biometric measures without my written signature, without telling me how they would be used, how long they would be kept, or when they would be destroyed. For instance, there was several awards, a big $1.25 million award against the Sephora cosmetic company. I think that was totally bogus. Sephora never should have been fined for that. They were taking your pictures of your face, finding your eyes, and then putting on eye makeup, virtually, and showing you what you would look like if you had purple lips and orange eyes and those things. And they agreed to an out-of-court settlement of $1.25 million because they were being accused of massive violations. It was not biometric recognition in the sense we believe it to be. On the other hand, down in Texas, the Texas law, the Biometric Information Protection Act down in Texas, does not allow for private individuals to make claims, but does allow the state of Texas to make claims. And get this, I hope I have the names right. Alphabet and Meta, I believe I have right, both agreed to $1.25 billion, that's billion with a B, dollar settlements with the state of Texas over their use of facial recognition on their platforms. They're out-of-court settlements. I can't understand or believe why they would agree to $1.25 billion $1 billion without trying to fight it in court. The way to fight it in court, these are very poorly worded acts. Nobody knows what these words mean. And I've been on working with a committee over the last year trying to come up with a definition for the word voice print. The word voice print appears in both of these acts, and nobody, voice printing was some, was a World War II speech spectrogram. And it went out of favor by the mid-1960s. And yet these acts both call out voice prints. Well, voice prints aren't being used. Well, maybe they didn't mean that. Maybe the writers of the act meant something else. What could they possibly have meant? Anyway, I've been working for quite some time with the committee trying to determine some definitions for these things.
What are the most common misconceptions about biometrics?
Well, I think the first one is the one that Wendy kind of brought up, that it's a technology. It's not a technology, it's a human computer interface. And if you're not as interested in the human as you are in the computer, you've missed the whole point, right? And that's why, what is the most accurate biometric technology? Well, I'm sorry, biometrics isn't a technology, it's an interface. And which are the most accurate humans? Well, I don't know how to answer that. Old people don't do very well, incidentally. Old people's faces are more stable. Our faces change less than younger people, but our fingerprints don't work so well. I don't know what cataracts do to iris images. I can't answer that question.
Cataracts, as I understand it, cataracts don't do much, but when you've had surgery and you have a new, your eye changes somewhat because they implant a new lens. And so that I believe you might have to re-enroll. I asked the World Orb people about that because, of course, they're using iris scans for their device, their sort of AI identifier device, and that was what they said was, yeah, you know, something like cataract surgery might require you to re-enroll because the new lens would make the iris look different.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, I don't really know. I don't know of any studies that have looked at that either.
I did find one at some point. I did sort of look around for something, and I think there's some indication that various eye conditions actually do have an effect.
Oh, yeah. That part is known. There's a surgical ophthalmologist here in the United States named Waters, Terry Waters, wonderful, wonderful man, who's been heavily involved in iris recognition research. And he has a whole list of ophthalmological problems that can cause changes in the iris.
And the other problem is people with their eye conditions where the eye doesn't stay stable at all and it moves a lot constantly.
Oh, pendular nystagmus.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, right. We have a friend, you and I have a mutual friend with pendular nystagmus.
Right. And you know, somebody like him just can't use a
yeah,
system.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the mask that I was wearing when I went through customs, the fallback on that was that they just sent me to a guy who looked at me, looked at my passport. In other words, the facial recognition thing they were doing took the place of a person just comparing the images. As a human being doing the comparison, and their fallback when it doesn't work is just to send you to somebody who does just that.
Yeah. And those people are, we know from plenty of testing, are far less accurate than the computers, and are far more subject to things like racial bias. We know about the other race effect, right? That if I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood, and so I really have trouble with people of Indian origin or people with very dark skin or even Asians separating one from another. I just don't see that. Now there's some of that. It carries over into automated recognition systems. They seem to do better on the races they're trained on. But humans have this terrible problem of being race blind, of being blind to certain races. Can't tell. They all look the same to me, right? And I admit to having that problem. And further, as you get older, you get face blindness. There's a word for that. I tend to be face blind. You know, I'll remember you as being the gray-haired guy with the gray beard and mustache. If I see you tomorrow and you've changed your hair and you changed your mustache and you changed your glasses, It's very likely I won't recognize you. No, but that's a common problem that occurs as people get older. They become increasingly face blind.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't realize that it was an age-related thing. I actually am pretty good at with faces and very bad with names, you know.
Okay.
I'm
All
one
right.
of those. And interestingly, I recall what you say about like this, they all look alike thing. As I got older and spent more time in contexts where I was around people of different races, I became less like that. I got so that I could really tell people apart better.
No, good
So
for
I
you.
think a lot of it is just an exposure thing.
No doubt. But my point being, that was one of the criticisms made in this Robert Williams case, is that Robert Williams was African American and the detectives were white, and they just said, "Oh yeah, African American, they clearly match." And it's one of the criticisms. I don't know if that's a fair criticism or not. But one of the criticisms then made in what happened to you is that you were put into a system that is inherently far more errant than the automated system. The automated system needs to buck it up and to learn to recognize people with mustaches and beards, which generally it can do. I can't explain why that particular system didn't like you.
It kind of shocked me. I didn't really, I mean, I wouldn't have expected that error to have taken place, but they didn't seem real surprised by it.
No, it's not.
I seem to recall this, somebody said something like, "Oh, this happens sometimes,"
Sure.
you know? So it could be that their particular system is just not as sophisticated as it might be. And I think it's a new system, you know, because the last time I went through customs, there wasn't a facial recognition system set up.
During COVID, the government, U.S. government, spent a
Yeah.
lot of money working on systems that would do the identification only from the visible parts of the face and not worry about what you had masked over your mouth. And some good progress was made. I guess that progress has not been built into the system they're deploying currently.
I remember that because people at the time were posting pictures of themselves with masks on social media sites, and then it came out that people were working on identifying them, and everybody panicked because they'd broken their own privacy for just, you know.
I think I was just jinxed on this trip because they also lost my luggage.
Oh.
Oh.
No wonder they didn't want to recognize you.
Exactly. It's really funny that so you have a technology now where you can have a tracker in your luggage, which I do. So I could watch where my luggage was going. And I one thing I saw was that they were supposed to FedEx it to me and they sent it totally the wrong place. And lost a day by doing that. And of course, I never would have known why I got it late if it wasn't for that. But that was not a facial recognition problem. It was more of a luggage recognition problem.
Is
So,
there anything, I mean, you know, with all the privacy complaints that there are about biometrics, and yet you want to keep working on making them more accurate. And sometimes I worry that if they were more accurate, they would be more popular among law enforcement to target people that don't necessarily deserve to be targeted. Do you ever worry about the consequences of what you're doing?
not very much. And let me tell you why. What you really need to do is to find a way of getting people to carry around a radio transmitter with them and to get them to pay money to carry that radio
I've
transmitter.
heard this one
And
before.
guess what? I do not leave home without my radio transmitter. And you know this. You've read plenty of true crime cases where after the fact they've gone back and they've tracked someone to the crime area at exactly the time the crime was committed, and they've used that as evidence that the person was at the scene of the crime at that time. You see this all the time.
There was a much more dramatic case, wasn't there, where they used the heart rate or something that the phone was capturing?
Oh, to determine the time of death, I think.
Yeah, or to determine, I think it was to determine whether the guy could have been engaged in the physical struggle that would have been necessary to kill the other guy. It was something like that. It was really weird. It was really complicated.
So the real risk to your privacy is the fact that you carry this around and that law enforcement has access, given the proper warrants, to obtain all of that information, which can narrow you down to just a few square meters. This is the problem. The idea of recognizing people in the street through facial recognition just doesn't work. I know the Chinese have talked this up, but that's more of a mind control psyops operation than anything is practical. You can't compare one person to the entire population and come up with anything reasonable. So in the case that you're talking about the UK police, the UK police have a very limited watch list, and I don't know what it is, but they're not trying to compare people that walk by their camera to every possible person in London. They have a very limited watch list of, let's say, 100 people at most, right? And now they're comparing everybody that walks by to 100 people. That's a much reduced problem in terms of size. But the best thing you can do, if you know who you're looking for, and you know their transmitter code, the best thing you can do is get them on the cell phone. So all of this talk about biometrics invading privacy seems a little bit weak if people aren't concerned about the fact that they're carrying around these transmitters every place they go. And these transmitters, to the extent that they're one-to-one correspondence, transmitter in person, right? They give very accurate data of where you are at every moment, not just when you've walked by a camera. Okay, now I've got good data that I walk by a camera, but this thing gives you good data every step I take, every place in the city or town or country for that matter.
Or at least of where your phone was.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That would be the defense. Well, somebody was carrying around my phone. It wasn't me. All right.
I've heard people say that we should have implants just like you do with your pets so that you can be identified. Is there any kind of move of that sort?
Didn't somebody actually have one of these implants? Isn't there a case where somebody did this?
I think aliens put implants in people so that they can track them. I think that's the X-Files story.
I mean, feel free if this is something you want to do. I personally know of nobody that does that, but I know of nobody who doesn't carry one of these things around. Forget the
No, but then,
implant or
there are some other cases though. The Madison Square Garden people, there was a case a couple of years ago where they were caught using facial recognition to identify people who worked for the law firms that were involved in litigation against them, even when the people themselves were not involved in the litigation. They would bar them from entry. And I think that's a very abusive use of facial
Oh, I
recognition.
think so too. But they got away with it. Now, if they'd known their cell phone number, that would have been more. Anybody with these cell phone numbers that walked into Madison Square Garden, we're going to nab them immediately.
Well, I don't know. That seemed pretty shocking to me.
I agree. I agree.
So, what music are you playing these days, Jim?
I personally playing. I just play old acoustic blues. That's all I do anymore. Or old man songs. Like there's some great old country western songs that go well with old men. But that's about all the music I'm playing these days. And what am I listening to these days? Actually, I haven't been listening to too much. I listen to all the old stuff. All the stuff from our generation. I'm still listening to.
Are you still listening to the Beach Boys?
Absolutely, absolutely.
As should everyone be.
And in the interview that you and I did 20 years ago, I talked about Jeff Foskett,
Yes, you did.
and he was the musical arranger for Brian William w Wilson and a guy that I knew, and Jeff would double Brian's voice so that if Brian faded out or couldn't sing a note, you'd always hear the note there. Both Jeff Foskett and Brian Wilson have died within the last year, as you've probably heard, which ends all of that.
I'd heard about Brian Wilson, but not Jeff Foskett.
Jeff died. Just too bad because he was actually a couple of years younger than me. He was not an old man at all.
He might have had a more complicated lifestyle.
I don't know. The when I met with him after your article, he certainly did not. He certainly was a very sane, sober, married, and a domestic kind of guy. Now, what he did earlier in his life, I just don't know. But I'm certain that for the last 20, 30 years of his life, he was certainly leading a professional lifestyle and avoiding any extremes entirely. He was a very, very sane, sober, rational, and logical person when I met with him as a result of the interview that you did with me.
Well, The story that I didn't tell in this discussion was that when we did that interview, we were in a Denny's because you couldn't get into your office.
Yeah, that's
And
right.
everybody watched with admiration as Jim demonstrated how to stand up on a surfboard in the middle of Denny's at Sunday brunch.
And the problem with my friends and I, everybody over 70 has real trouble standing up anymore. It's really hard to stand up quickly on a surfboard. So a lot of us are riding on our knees. That seems to be the big thing with the older guys. Or to have a stand-up surfboard in the first place where you're already standing up and don't need to stand up. You can do those two things.
Yeah, I was thinking about that recently, about how, you know, I always kind of wanted to surf and I couldn't do it now because I'd probably get myself killed or maimed.
You could do it on a bodyboard.
Snow skiing, whatever.
You could do it on a bodyboard, you could do it on a stand-up board.
And I do that. I do the, what do they call it, a boogie board?
Yeah.
Well,
that's the direction that my guys are taking. Now, since my friends all have big boards already, they just boogie board on a big board.
It helps me to know that Brian Wilson never was a surfer either.
No.
So. Even though he certainly wrote about it enough. Well, we're pretty much at the end of our hour, Jim. You got anything else you want to say before we drop off?
Well, I apologize for monopolizing this last hour. I should have let you talk more.
No,
I think that was your job, actually.
You're the guest, yeah.
That's the whole idea, is we can talk to each other all the time, but we don't get to talk to you all the time.
That's right.
Well, call me up anytime. I'm always here and always willing to talk.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely ask you back.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.